Hi, my name is Marcus, and this is a companion podcast for the CG Jung Help Desk Meetup Group. I host live events on Zoom every 2 weeks about the concepts and ideas of the Swiss psychologist Carl Gustav Jung. Every event, I give a presentation about the Jungian concept, so have fun with this event's topic.
And I want to welcome you all to today's event about perception and experience, some topics where I struggled a little bit to get an overarching theme. So last event was dreams. There you have a very good way to structure everything to see, okay, what is a dream? How did Jung approach dreams? What is interpretation? And so on. I really tried to find some hook or overarching structure for this event and failed a little bit, I think. But everything is related to perception. Everything is related to experience. But it will be more like a collection of the views of Jung. And Jung was a very famous Swiss psychoanalyst, psychologist, professor. He taught, he wrote, he traveled the world to experience and analyze people all over the world, traveled to India, to Africa, to America, and just learn a lot. This was really the time where the world became already connected. And there were very different institutions that tried to gather the knowledge of the world. It was the beginning of the 20th century, and had Ranos that had annual meetings where people would present all the knowledge that they could find from ancient cultures and art and so on. And it was this huge boom of just knowledge about everything that human beings have been doing for hundreds, thousands of years. And Jung was right in the middle there as a psychoanalyst who went his own way to explore deeper the mysteries, let's say, of a human experience and what human experience meant for people through the time and how they codified it in culture, in mythology, in religion, in storytelling and everything, and try to really connect everything. And his way of connecting it, or rather finding out that there were a lot of connections that he did not think about before, is through psychology and the psyche, because there is what the basis of everything, which is there for every human being. And he looked at it, how humans experience things, because as a psychoanalyst, he had a lot to do with schizophrenics and people who were psychotic, people who were neurotic and paranoid and so on. And they had a very special view on things. And he noticed that this view did not differ so much from the experience that people, for example, have when they dream, or how things are codified in mythology and in religion, that there are certain themes that come up again and again. And this laid the foundation for his works into the collective parts of human psyche, of the human nature, which is same for all the human beings and is like an underground connection to everyone, and where you are connected to basically every human being that ever existed, even when it's thousands or tens of thousands years ago, and even to animals. And he begins his psychological view of human experience really with the center of experience, which is the ego. And the best way to describe the ego is you sitting here now and experiencing this presentation and being aware of it. This is the ego and the ego function, where just it's a spotlight in the dark that's looking around and illuminating the world and becoming aware of the world. And around it, consciousness forms like a web, and everything that's experienced gets connected to this web of consciousness. So when you, for example, learn a new language, the experience of the new language is rather strange because it's just sounds and you can't make heads or tail of it. So for the last years, I learned Russian because of my wife. She's Ukrainian and we don't speak Russian anymore at home. But the experience of learning a language is you have the sounds, you have, and you can't really understand words, sentences. You don't get the meanings. You don't even understand where one word begins and when it ends. So it is through learning the language that you're then able to understand, these sounds mean this, and so on. And with time, it's able to realize that there are pauses between words that you normally don't recognize when you don't know the language so well, but then there comes this fine-grained adjustment to it, to the sounds, to make a categorization and realize, okay, now you have words, you have sentences, you have meaning. And the slow uncovering process is, the language is already there, the people are saying something, but you cannot really process this in your mind. And this is a conscious function for Jung, to be able to integrate these foreign parts, for example, from a language into your own consciousness, to be able to understand the language, speak the language, act with it willfully. But not only the willfully part to speak, for example, but really this perception part. And the reason that Jung saw for consciousness, and which makes human beings a little bit unique of having consciousness, at least in Jung's views, is that consciousness for Jung is a mitigator. It's a problem solver. So the reason for consciousness is to solve a problem and for the ego to spring into action and to do something. Everybody knows this, that there's, let's say, two very different modes of being. One is quite automatic. For example, when you brush your teeth or when you drive a car or when you go to work, the body does it all by itself. So you're so used to it and you have these patterns down so much that you don't have really to think about it. This is especially prevalent when you speak a new language. At a certain point, you don't have to think about speaking a new language. Or when you play an instrument, you don't have to think about playing the instrument at a certain point. This is the automatic mode, but then there's a more conscious attention mode. For example, when you make a mistake in a language and you have to think about it, or when something unforeseen happened, for example, you drive your car to work as you have done it hundreds of thousands of times, and suddenly your motor acts up or a tire blows, suddenly you're 100% aware what's happening. There's a very good book by Daniel Kahneman, Thinking Fast and Slow. And he writes about these two systems, systems one and system two, which has very different jobs in acting and in experiencing by having this very automatic, fast responses, automatic motions and automatic reactions and so on. And then this very deliberate, slow and very taxing mode of being. When you're learning something new and you have to concentrate, you can't keep up this level of consciousness and awareness for a very long time. So it is necessary to be aware. So when you learn a new language, you really have to concentrate on the new words, on grammar and all those stuff, and listen very closely. And this is this system too, where you have to pay a lot of attention to bring it into this automatic mode. So if you do it often enough, then it becomes automatically and you don't have to think about it. When you get more professional in the language, you can listen to it longer. You can read in it longer than 5 minutes, 10 minutes, maybe for hours even. And this is then automatically. So, but the work of consciousness is to bring together very different demands. So you have your internal desires, your needs, your things you have to do, you want to do. And of course, you have the external circumstances that also want things from you, and that pose certain limitations that you then try to mitigate. I don't know how many of you have seen Rick and Morty, but I think in the first season, there's this figure of Meeseeks who gets spawned and is living just for a specific task. And for example, Meeseeks has to grab a bottle of water and then he brings back the bottle of water and disappears. And consciousness is like that. So there's a problem, it needs to be solved, and it's a very active state. And as soon as the work is done, consciousness can turn back, because being conscious all the time is incredibly taxing. People have to sleep 8 hours a day. And when you work very hard mentally, you're also tired and you have to lie down and do something else, turn off your mind, watch TV, whatever, just to recharge this consciousness again. So consciousness tries to do novel, complicated, new stuff, to integrate it into the psyche of the person, to learn something, to be better. And Jung had this great quote that I found, and he said, "Nobody will ever become conscious if he does not hit his head on something." And this is what therapy is very often about, to hit people onto something and let them become aware of something that they tried to turn away from, that they tried not to be aware of, and to get this mode of having new information integrated into the psyche. So we have our consciousness. It's now active. It's supposed to do something. It has a job. And we don't have so much time because it's getting tired very easily. And part of this automatic process that's running in the background is the psychic background of the psyche. And this is the part that is always a question whether it's cultural or natural, how much is given from human nature, how much is shaped through outside, whether it's coming from outside or inside. And we have so many perceptive function and experience function that are automatically that we don't really think about it, that we cannot really say whether we objectively see the world, or rather that we see it in a subjective manner. And we think it's objective because everybody sees the same way. The example that Jung had was, we don't really see wavelengths, we see colors. So wavelengths are there. They are electromagnetic wavelengths that are everywhere. You have a huge spectrum that goes from microwaves, when you have a microwave, or nuclear radiation, or cell towers, and all of this. But you have a very small spectrum, roughly from 300 to 700 nanometers, where you see colors. And if it's within the spectrum, you can see it. If it's not, it's outside. You have certain animals who are night predators who can see rather more into, I think it was the infrared part, and their eyes and their psyche is more accustomed to see this, to have the ability to see this. But we don't really see the wavelengths with the numbers. We see colors, and this is an automatic process. And this is something that is, again, unique for human beings to see colors, because many animals in the world, they can't see colors. For example, dogs, black and white, many animals not able to see colors. So humans have very great vision. Same with music or audio in general. You have wavelengths in the air, which is just atoms moving, and the brain automatically generates out of that music sounds, a foreign language that you're trying to learn at the moment. So it is already something happening automatically that is similar to this example from the fish swimming in the water and not being aware of the water because the water is always there. We always see color normally. We can always hear normally. So it's just a given and a foundation for our experiences. But when we now see something and when we hear something, it goes for Jung farther than this, in the sense that we are only being able to aware and be process of things that can latch on onto consciousness. This is again the example of language. When you have a foreign language that you don't know what it says, you can't really distinguish the words or the sentences. There's nothing in consciousness there in the psyche where this could be processed correctly. So it goes right through. And this filtering, of course, is not only for languages, but rather to understanding concepts in general. And this makes it very hard when you learn something new, for example, Jungian psychology, to get a grip on it, because everything is suddenly strange and foreign. And you maybe have ideas how it could be, but only through time and enough examples, you'll be able to process that. And this is a filtering that's taking place. And additionally to that, you have consciousness, which is small, limited, has a task, and is not able to keep up for a very long time. And it's focused to very, very specific things. It's similar to the eye, where the area you can really see is pretty much as big as your thumbnail. When you stretch out the arm and raise up the thumb and look at your thumb, the part of the eye that you can see very clearly is roughly the size of your thumbnail. And everything else, the brain basically makes up. There's some rough shapes and so on, and the rest gets basically interpreted by the brain automatically. But because you're scanning around with your eyes and everywhere where you look directly, you have this very fine view on things that's high resolution. You think, ah, everything is high resolution. Yeah, everything is high resolution if you look at it, if you look everywhere. And this is part of consciousness, and this is a downside of consciousness, this extreme limitation. But it's like a very small hole where the whole world has to fit through and where the world channeled through. So Jung saw not really that people were seeing and experiencing the objective world, that they're just objects outside and we see them really as they are, but rather we have a perception of them. And this was not really for him a downside. He did not say just because it's subjective, does it mean that it's not real? Because that's a normal expectation that people have. So, okay, yeah, I see the objective world, I see the material stuff, and this is what is real. This is a very materialistic view. Even subjective experience can be real, even when one is alone that experiencing it, especially everything inside the psyche. And he said, real is what works. Real is what has an effect on people. When somebody has a neurosis or schizophrenic breakdown, it does not bring something to tell the person, yeah, that there are no voices here in the room. No, the things you are seeing or you're imagining are not real because they're not physically here. They are real because the person is experiencing them. It has an effect on the person, these experiences and the things that they are perceiving. So they have to be taken seriously. And here Jung was on the bleeding edge, let's say, of psychology. Psychology back then was a very new science. And in the past, it was said when people would have mental problems, that they would have a damaged brain, which is a materialistic view, right? You have the brain, it's damaged, it can't work properly. So what you do, you take the people, lock them away. And people were locked away in very horrible conditions because they were damaged goods. Nothing you could do. You just wait till they die. And Jung said the conditions, they were so horrible that even normal people would go crazy, would they need to live in there. But this was around the time when psychoanalysis came up with Freud. And there was a view of, it's not that the brain is damaged, but rather the people have a psychological problem, like a knot inside their psyche that needs to be solved and can be solved through talking. Jung, Freud established this idea of the talking therapy, that you can talk with people through their problems, through their experiences and their perceptions. Jung said one of the reasons what make psychotic episodes and schizophrenic episodes so dangerous was that people saw that they were going crazy. So they would perceive something, experience something that was so out of the ordinary that they said to themselves, I can't really tell anyone about this because people would not understand. They would say, I would be crazy. And people would go then into, and this was Jung's view, into a kind of isolation where they would try to remove themselves from family, friends, society, and so on, which is rather enforcing these problems, unsolved problem like a trauma in the back of the mind, something that could not be processed, something where consciousness realized it cannot process this. Same as you would eat something and you would vomit and give up. The body knows what it can process and what it cannot process. Even the tongue is already able to know before it's in the stomach whether something is good or not. For example, poisons are very bitter, and the taste of bitterness is especially to find out about poisons. And this is why small children especially are incredibly sensible to bitterness and bitter taste and dislike them and don't want to eat anything bitter because it would be harmful for the child in the development. And the psyche can do basically the same, according to Jung, realize whether it can process something or not. And here he would then sit down with the patients and let them talk and let them know that it's understood and something normal is happening to them. And he had even one patient who had crazy visions about burning wheels and everything. And he said he's afraid to talk to anyone and nobody would understand and so on. And he felt like he's the only person who had ever had this in the whole of humanity. And Jung said, let me grab a book. And he reached into his shelf, grabbed the 400-year-old alchemic treaty and showed him the page with a picture and said, you're not alone. You're not the first one to have this. Somebody else had it 400 years ago. And this would give people already the strength and understanding that they're not alone and that they could reconnect, that they're not outside of humanity, that they have not experienced something that would mark them as an outcast, but rather they have just an unusual experience, which is not unusual if taking enough people and enough time. But this idea of real is what works. When people have a vision and an experience and it has a lasting impression on them, it means it's real to them. Feelings are real, thoughts are real. As soon as they influence how we think, how we behave, and so on, it's the same as when we walk against a tree or a car drives into us. It's the same realness, but from another perspective, not from the outside, but from the inside. So it is this felt experience. What Jung would try to say to unify this, that we have this outside world and we have this inside world, where the rules are different but similar in the way how they are processed. He would say that the mind, the psyche, would codify this in images. So everything we do, that we touch, and that we get into contact with, turns into a psychic image and into a psychic content. And we rather react and interact with the psychic contact than with the outside thing. We might think that the outside thing is what we think it is, but we are more or less interacting with the psychic content that's then in the psyche. Example, when you see a murder mystery movie, you see it and you think, ah, this is a killer. The movie is structured in a way to bring you to this conclusion, but then it comes out, ah, something else happened entirely. So the brain and the mind constantly tries to predict what something is. Of course, often has to do with a very little information. Rather, take something that it knows and that it already has in its repertoire and its consciousness and use it and say, okay, yeah, this fits. And this is like a solution that works so long as until the point where it does not work anymore. And then consciousness has to come back and say, okay, what I know did not fit. Now I have to find something new. This is especially true when you, for example, do troubleshooting and you have a problem with your computer, your car, whatever at work, and you think you know what the problem is, and then you find out, oh no, I had no idea what the problem is. And I have to think about what really the problem is. Finding out the problem is already half of the work, if not even more. So it does not matter really if it comes from outside or from inside. It becomes a psychic content image as soon as we are in contact with it. So there's this labeling taking place that something is outside or inside, but everything gets mingled together in the mind. So everything gets into one pot. And here Jung sees, and we are basically looking at the pot, our ego, our consciousness looking in the pot and see, okay, well, what's there? And here Jung tries to explain how there can be psychological experiences that are not based on the outside world. How you can, for example, see, experience a ghost or encounter God or an angel or the devil or demons or whatever, to have these experiences in there and they feel real. And even when you close your eyes, very likely you have images that just pop up. Or when you dream, you also have images that pop up and that can feel real in the sense that they have an effect on you. And when you have a nightmare, you don't question the reality of the nightmare because it happened to you. You experienced it, even though that outside nothing happened. You have the images inside and outside. Jung goes even further to say, we don't see the objective world. We see something very subjective, like a subjective interpretation of the world that we are not really aware of because we have biases, we use heuristics and everything. He did not say that, but he alluded to it, that it would be the modern terms for it, that the psyche has to use certain shortcuts to basically make sense of the world, because the world is endless and it's big and limitless, and we only have a very small brain in comparison, a very limited brain. And you can see this also in optical illusions, that our visual cortex is using certain tricks to get a result, which can be then bypassed or misused to create an optical illusion and give the impression that something looks, for example, 3D, even though that's not really 3D for real. So we see this pre-filtered content. We have so several layers of filtering happening. We have something, it becomes an image that is then where able to perceive it or not, whether it's already part of our consciousness, whether it can dock somewhere. This is why it's been so boring in school so often, because a lot of information, there's just no access point to dock it. And the more you learn about something, and the more you know about something, the more you can process new information, and the more fun it is. The most fun is to do things that you can do already well, and you can develop there. This is a flow state, not something that Jung has been talking about directly. He did not call it flow state, but to have this conscious development going on. And then, of course, you have your personality that's filtering additionally how you see the world. And he had a personality structure. He called it a typology, where he said we have certain cognitive functions or more perceiving functions. His model of personality was very much based on perception and experiencing things. So the four functions were sensation, thinking, feeling, and intuition. Sensation meaning to be experiencing something is there. So there is something. Outside there's a tree. Inside there's an emotion. Then thinking is a labeling. So I already said it. Outside there's something. It's a tree. Labeling, it's rage when it's an emotion. And feeling, doing like a value judgment, whether you are happy that the tree is there or you're not happy that the tree is there. For example, when you drove your car and there's suddenly a tree where you don't expect it. Maybe you're happy about the rage for what reason ever. You're at a sports game or something. And then intuition, to basically perceive something through the unconscious, which is not directly there, but rather possibility that something could be in the future. It's more like a time function. So you see there are different channels where information can come into the psyche and to the ego and to consciousness, where he based his typology around to say, okay, there are certain venues that people like more. Thinking people like thinking a lot, and sensation people like sensating a lot. And those people live different ways because they like to do it that way. He said, for example, sensation people are very likely stockbrokers. They see the numbers and things that are happening there. So they are really just what is there now in this moment. And intuitive people are more artistic and artists. They rather see possibilities. For example, gamblers. So gamblers have to believe that there's a win to keep on gambling. Hunters, he said. So people who try to perceive things that are not really there, but who really like to do it that way. And it is because there's this kind of favorite channel that the focus on perceiving the world is on that, which is another limitation. There are many different ways to do it, but you have a favorite one. And it's just, he said that everybody comes into the world with a favorite function that they like to use the most and most likely build a career around because they are most capable. It's like when you have a strong hand and a weak hand, you rather use the strong hand all the time. And it is this additional layer of filtering that's happening so that you're actually removing more and more from what we would call objective, all the things that are happening outside and they are graspable, that they get filtered and disturbed through different ways. And we are then focused with our consciousness on only small things, very likely in our favorite function, which is only one of four. And additionally, he said this labeling of inside and outside is not really an easy feat to say, okay, I'm touched by something. And it, of course, it can come from inside and come from outside, and the labeling takes place. But that does not mean that we can really separate what is outside really happening and what is inside happening. And he said that this is one very specific state, which was way more common back then, where consciousness was not strong because consciousness has this separating, discriminating function of being very able to just separate things from another. He said the reason why, for example, in antiquity and in hunter-gatherer societies, people had very strong feelings about rivers, trees, stones, and so on, and said, there's a god living in the river, and there's a nymph living in the tree, and so on, was that they are thinking they're perceiving the outside world, but rather it is from the inside world. They were looking into the pot where all the images come together and did like a mislabeling, let's say. The separation from the outside world and the inside world being the psyche, is not really very accurate. This phenomenon he called participation mystique, wasn't his term. And it's this spreading out of the psychology that people think what they're experiencing outside is outside, but rather it is something from their own psychology. Example, astrology, when we look into the night sky and we see the stars, it's if we want to be very unromantic, just bright dots. It's very strangely distributed all over the night sky, and they have different intensity and so on. And what human beings saw there were constellations. They saw the fishes, and they saw a ram, and they saw scales and the scorpion and so on, and they saw whole stories, and they saw gods. Those are, let's say, a human invention, but humans did not think that they invented something, but rather that they perceived something. Jung said they perceived their own psychology. They saw how the psyche was working and saw it outside and recorded it. And those are the things he was very interested in this projected psychology, how people saw things, because this very often would tell him, okay, what is happening inside, just that through people saying what they see, what they perceive, to see what the inside of the head looks like and what they actually see. And he had this example of painters. You can have 10 painters and put them in the same spot and tell them, okay, paint what you see. You get different paintings, which is not only based on the capability of the people, how well they can paint, but rather also what they can see, what they perceive, where their attentional focus lies at. And he calls this Weltanschauung, so worldview, that people look into the world and they have a certain expectation how it is and how it works based on their own psychology. So people, he would say, had a very specific focus, same as a favorite function. People would have a perspective rather if they like the outside world or the inside world. And the outside world, he would say, there were strong empiricists and they would go through the world and try to experience it in its all its individuality. And there would be more outgoing. He called them extroverted, and he coined the term, and he coined also the other term, introversion. So the people who are rather looking inside and try to see the world rather through concepts and mental constructs and ideas. So they're not really looking outside in the world directly, but rather looking in their own psyche to see rather a reflection of the real world inside themselves. That's the way how people prefer to experience the world when they're introverted. And this worldview, again, is something that people are not really aware of. You become aware of it when you, for example, talk with other people and talk about what you see. The term for personality psychology, so psychology about personality and personal differences, is differential psychology, only talks about the differences between people. So everything where people are different, there you can specify, there you can talk about. But if people are all the same, it makes it hard to talk about something and to have these differences between people. And this Weltanschauung worldview, he said, is of course very strong when you have artistic people or when you have philosophers. And he would say that about a lot of philosophers, that they made a confession about their own psychology by saying how they see the world. He talked a lot about Hegel and said Hegel wasn't for him a real philosopher, not like Schopenhauer, for example, but rather somebody who had a very strong worldview and talked about it and was not aware that Hegel was not experiencing the world as it is, but rather his own psychology projected in the world by looking into the pot, seeing those images and label them not in the correct way. But this is easier said than done, because knowing really what is outside and what is inside is a strong feat. So additionally to all those layers I talked about, there's a layer he called attitude. And this is really what the expectations would be of the people, how they think about things. And he would talk that mainly in the context of the unconscious, because the unconscious is everything that the consciousness is not, but it is automatic functions happening in the background and interacting with consciousness. For example, when you dream, the unconscious pushes up images and voices, sounds that the ego then experiences. And based on the strangeness of the contents and the view that people would have of the unconscious, the images would change. The perception and experience would be very different. So he noted, for example, that extroverted people, people who are outside and perceive the outside, don't really believe in these automatic, unconscious, psychological phenomena that are happening in the background. And being able to be aware of that and expect that and be able to process that, which also plays in this idea of the schizophrenics and psychotic people or people who have these episodes, not being able to integrate that into their consciousness, not able to process it because there's nothing to dock there, is this idea of consciousness not being able to handle this and thus having a bad attitude towards, for example, unconscious contents, because suddenly things are moving that should not move. When you're alone at home and suddenly things start moving, of course you're afraid because you cannot really categorize what is happening. So people would say that a ghost or like a foreign presence there. And Jung said that in relationship to the unconscious, very important to be aware that there's something as the unconscious, that it is working autonomously, but also that it's part of oneself. That is a little bit like an accident that certain things are separated from consciousness, because again, it's filtered in such a way that we only have a small view of the world. So if we only, let's say, live passively and let things rain down on us, the things, the consciousness, the worldview that we have is rather limited. And it is this active part, this aware part and open part that makes it possible to have this internal view of the world grow. And here I said the attitude part is very important. What is the attitude towards things? And this is happening in therapy, he said, when he talks to people, to set things in a correct frame, to give it a correct context, to make it understandable. Same as showing this alchemical treaty to his patient who had this very weird experience, but also to talk with people about the things they don't want to talk about, personal problems, trauma, and to be not only, and this is this complicated thing to explain, it is through the attitude that determines how the unconscious looks like. So the unconscious for Jung is threatening the more the consciousness tries to get away from it. So it becomes bigger, more frightening, the more you try to turn away from it. It's a little bit in the movie Jaws, where the events get worse and worse and worse and worse because Brody is not the protagonist, is not approaching the shark, but rather running away from the shark. Because there's this relationship between how you act and how you perceive the things. So I hope I could explain this attitude concept well enough. So we have our consciousness that is acting and is perceiving very filtered, very incomplete information, but has a possibility to work in all those different ways. When we're focused on the outside, we can also choose to pay attention to the inside. When we have our favorite function, there's also the possibility to actively learn about the other ways of perceiving the world and to be aware that not everything that we experience outside has to be really outside, but rather there's also a labeling process happening that's happening through us and can happen automatically, but it can also happen willfully and then be integrated so that this attitude, the correct attitude and context and reframing for perceptions and experience, that they can be used in a useful manner and processed in the psyche of the people. And this active approach Jung saw in consciousness and in ego. And the problem that there is for Jung in an unconscious state, nothing really has to make sense. Everything can be completely intertangled, intertwined, and undifferentiated, unsophisticated. But as soon as you focus on a certain part, get it outside of the unconscious. And you only focus, again, this very small thumbnail part of your awareness and focus very clearly on small parts of reality, but very often only on that part. And he says we are separating things by being conscious of something and paying attention to something, because you're only focusing on a small part and have to ignore everything else. When you drive your car, you try to concentrate on the road and you try to ignore everything around you, the landscape, even how your back feels. And only after hours and hours, your back says like, okay, please make a pause, make a stretch. And by focusing on one thing, the other thing automatically gets discounted. So when you only focus on the outside, you ignore the inside, because consciousness, limited, small, tires easily, can only focus on a small part, and when it's only in the outside, the inside, the internal world gets ignored. So you have this automatic separation happening as soon as you do something and become more aware of something. And in the unconscious, the counterpart automatically gets constellated. So a little bit in school, for example, primary school, when one would play with watercolors, you have all those different colors. And when you start to mix them, they all become brown in the end. So if you try to imagine this process in reverse, and you would start pulling out colors, you would have brown, this intertangled mess, right, where you can not really do something with it unless you want to have the color brown, but brown is also a little bit boring. If you want to have bright yellow, you have to think about that consciousness is removing this yellow part out of the brown part. And then being able to use yellow as a color, being separated from the rest. And a consciousness that's well developed can really take out all the colors again out of the brown mass and make use of them all, so that there's green and blue and orange and so on. And this is where how Jung saw fundamentally how people perceive things by differences, by opposites. And here he saw also the way why people do something, because there's something not right. A little bit like electricity, you have a positive and you have a negative. Only if there's a difference in load, electrical load, then you have things happening between them. So a battery has uneven load in the sense that there's an equilibrium that's trying to return to this equilibrium state. And it's this separation part that generates energy, that generates things happening, because suddenly the unconscious becomes very aware to remind consciousness of there are all those other colors. That's not only yellow. You have to also think about all the other things. And Jung saw this codified in a lot of symbology worldwide. For example, in Yin and Yang, the Tao symbol, where you have the white snake with the black eye and the black snake with the white eye, that you have separation of both. And they both have to be, in a sense, separated to be perceived, but they, in the end, have to be unified in a new manner. So you have to take out all the colors and return them, let's say, to a place where every color can exist for itself, but still be part of the same set to be made use of. And it is the work of consciousness and the life's work that one has to make all those unconscious contents conscious and integrate them into consciousness. And this is for Jung individuation, to take this whole mess, to have this brown soup and extract all the colors again, because the colors are prettier than only the brown mass and the brown liquid. And here Jung tried to explain where the difficulties lie, even on a perceptual level, how we see the world, that it's not to say, okay, what I see is real, what I experience is, it is real because it's happening to me, but does not mean that I automatically understand what I'm perceiving, what I'm experiencing. And that this, this conscious investigation into the experience, into the perception, that makes it possible to create a well-formed human being, and human being that is able to solve problems, to live a life, to live a fulfilling life. And he saw that really, that there's a function in the psyche that is telling people that they're living a fulfilling life, that they are on the right track. That there's always in the background something that's reminding people whether they're seeing the world and experiencing the world correctly. Because if they don't do it, the unconscious always pushes and tries to steer the person back on the right path. And he goes even so far when somebody is intuitive and the person is supposed to think, because the thinking is not very well developed, that the psyche and the body would cause the person to have an accident or to get sick just to stay at one place and not be all around those possibilities, but rather to think about this now. So the unconscious and the psyche tries to make people go there and do that what they most likely don't want to do, don't like to see, and don't like to experience, to say like, hey, there's a whole big world and you only have a very small part of it that you have seen and that you have understood. So there's a lot of work more to do for you. And this would be my conclusion to the topic of perception and experience. And I hope it was structured well enough so that you could follow and learn something and also had maybe a little bit of fun.
This was this event's topic. Thanks for tuning in. During an event, a discussion part follows after the presentation where all attendees discuss the just presented topic or other Jungian concepts. If you also want to join, find the group on meetup.com. The name of the group is CG Jung Help Desk. Also make sure to subscribe to the podcast on the platform of your choice. See you next time.